What motivates women to become pilots in the male-dominated field of aviation, and what lessons for all of us can be learned from that experience? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. You may know Diane Ballwig as an entrepreneur and philanthropist, owner and president of the Enders Manufacturing Company Foundation, but did you know she was a pioneer in the field of aviation, named the Pink Pilot? Her 2024 book is entitled Into the Wind, Above the Clouds, Love at First Flight. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily.
How did you come to the decision to write a book about your experience with being the Pink Pilot?
I've always been a teacher, and so I've always worked on classroom and learning lessons. But there were a couple aviation magazines that asked me if I would write just an article for them. And when I started writing, and when I travel, I always write like a logbook of what I'm doing. I just kind of got consumed in going back and recalling those memories, and I loved it. So when COVID set in and I wasn't teaching, I thought, you know what, I'm going to start putting down some of these good stories and memories, life lessons learned, not just for aviators or pilots, but for anybody, and see if I can put this into a book. And so that's what prompted it. Usually when I start a talk or a presentation, there's always a gentleman there. And I reach out my hand to shake his hand, and I'll say, do you know that statistically, you'd have to walk down the street and shake hands randomly with 5,623 women before you shook hands with a female pilot? And then I shake my head and smile and say, it's your lucky day.
That's great. And I did want to ask you about how unusual it is and was back when you became a pilot, how unusual that was for a woman to crack that kind of glass ceiling. So tell us a little bit, first of all, about your background and what maybe helped prepare you for an unconventional role, and then what got you into flying to begin with.
Yeah, people often ask that question. I really was in a family steel construction business. An only daughter, and I only have one brother, but he wasn't interested in being involved in it. And then I went into education. I taught Spanish. I taught special ed. I have a music degree, and so I taught music for years. But I've always loved, and I didn't travel as a kid, but I loved traveling as I got older and had a little more freedom. What got me into flying is I had three kids, and they all went far away to college. And it was just like we could never get away to visit them. So the one word I use is practical. I had no idea, no history of it. But once I went out to the airport and did their introductory flight, it was kind of like I was smitten and loved it.
And what about it did you fall, you know, you say you were smitten. What is it that you experienced that then got you?
I think two things come to mind really quickly. The beauty, it's beautiful. When I grew up in the Madison area, but you could see it from the air, the lakes and the cornfields and the rolling meadows, that was lovely. But the other word was freedom. I was always the point person for the family and for so many agencies and businesses and students that when I was up in the air, nobody could find me or get me. And I had freedom that I never experienced before. So the word that got me flying was practical. I had one child that went to Boston University, one went to Ann Arbor, and one went to Denver University, and I flew to all three places to visit them, and that was a wonderful advantage.
And when you were deciding you were going to become a pilot, I know you encountered some naysayers, some chauvinists. You quote one who said, if women were meant to fly, God would have made the sky pink, but you can clearly see it's blue.
That's why I got the name the Pink Pilot, because when I learned to fly, and it was about 25 years ago, less than 5% of the entire aviation industry, and that included flight attendants and ticket takers and baggage claim, less than 5% were female. At that time, they claimed that only about 2% of pilots were female. That now has gone up. There are about 5% of all pilots are female.
That's
but it's still
low.
A very
yeah, that's low.
Small world. Yeah. So I became the Pink Pilot, and I used to feel guilty. I have a plane and a hangar at the Madison Airport, And I taught aviation at Edgewood High School for 20 years, and I'd always have like an open house and a reception. I took students flying on weekends, had parents out, and I would host things at the Pink Pilot Lounge, which sounded a little risque, and I felt guilty. And then I thought, no, that's what everybody knows and calls it. As far as I know, I'm the only female plane and hangar owner. Just a year ago, we had a business meeting at the airport in the main terminal because they were going to resurface all the taxiways and runways. I walked into the room, this is a year ago, and people looked at me in the usual way like, what is that woman doing in this room? And I sat down at the table with some pilots that I know and that know me, and I counted. And there were 28 men in the room, including airport administration and architects and the people that were going to do the work, and one woman, and that was me. And I shake my head and think, we really haven't changed that much.
And why do you think that is? I mean, what about being a pilot or aviation in general would be intimidating to too many women, do you think?
I did a survey, now this is at least 10 years ago, asking students why a lot of my classes were mostly boys and men. Some years I didn't have any girls. And the line that I hear is they don't have role models. Mm-hmm. And that comes up frequently. We have young eagle rallies at the airport where members of the EAA, Experimental Aircraft Association, give free rides to kids. One time I was one of the pilots and we were taking kids for free rides and there was a father standing there and he had two daughters. And I said, oh, there's a couple pilots that are free. You can go over there. And he said, no, I'll wait till you have. And I said, well, they're really good pilots. Why don't you go there? And he said, no, I want my daughters to fly with a female pilot so they have a role model. And that even opened up my eyes that I wasn't even thinking of that at the time. So there is now a Four Lakes Women in Aviation chapter in Madison. I think that helps a little bit. We are doing science night and STEM nights at schools. We set up a table and we have all kinds of activities for the kids. And maybe it's good that they see women manning that table because there will be role models that they can project their future.
You talk about a few women from earlier times who flew, including Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady to do that. And then, of course, there's the whole mystery surrounding Amelia Earhart and a few other women. I think you mentioned one who had to go, the first African-American female pilot who had to go to France to get her license. Because they wouldn't do it here. And, you know, some obstacles definitely that got in the way.
Yeah. Emily, there's a story with that, too, that I was on a delegation to Japan, and I was representing our then Governor Doyle and the state of Wisconsin. I was leading this delegation. It's a longer story, but every time they introduced me, at the end, they would always say, this person is, and they'd say it with a Japanese accent, a pirate. And they meant pilot, but I became known as the pirate. And everybody would put their hands together and bow, and they would gasp and go, oh! And I wondered why they were so in awe of me being a pilot. Well, that was in June. It was about 20 years ago now. And I came home and I went to EAA in Oshkosh, and they gave awards. And one of the awards was to the first female Japanese woman to get her pilot's license. And she had to come to America to do it. And that was only maybe 2 months after I'd come home from Japan. And I thought, oh, that's why they were so awestruck. They didn't allow women to become pilots and to be introduced to a female pilot. And now somebody in Japan got their pilot's license. So you continue, as you said, to learn along the way about all things in all different countries.
Each chapter of your book ends with a lesson. And they're lessons not just about flying, but sort of life lessons. But this one is, color does not determine ability. No human being should be invisible. We should not be judged by the color of our skin, nor should we judge by gender, pink or blue. Spread your wings and fly. I think that's such beautiful thoughts there. So you took what happened to you in terms of attitudes about being a female pilot and kind of generalize it about how we put people in boxes and don't let them reach their full potential.
Right, right. You know that I do love quotes.
Yes.
And I have some quotes that, can I share three of
absolutely.
Them that relate to what you said? One is from a lady named Karen Miller. She was an American journalist. And she said, "When someone tells me no, it doesn't mean I can't do it. It simply means I can't do it with them." That sort of relates to, I went through a lot of people that were very critical about me taking flying lessons because I was a mother of three kids and they were like, "Don't you know how dangerous that is? And why would you risk that?" And then I took my daughter at the time and we did a self-fly safari in Africa, just mother and daughter. And she was probably about 14 years old. We flew over the Kalahari Desert in a Cessna. We flew over Victoria Falls and we had a great time. I look back at those wonderful memories and I think I'm glad I did it. There's two other quotes, and I always shared this with my students, my aviation students. Some of them are inspirational, but some of them just make you shake your head. And one is from, his name was Charles Duell. He was the commissioner of the U.S. Patent Office in 1899. So when you think of him as being the commissioner of the patent office, you would think he would be very optimistic about what the future could invent. Mm-hmm. But this is right before planes were invented. He said, "Everything that can be invented has been invented."
In 1899.
Yes. Yes. And then 4 years later, the Wright brothers proved him wrong. In their small plane, the Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur, had to flip a coin to see who would get on the plane because it would only carry the weight of one person. Now the Airbus 360 carries 400 people and luggage and baggage and food. And it's just incredible how fast we've come. So I'll share one more quote, and this was Orville Wright. And again, it's surprising because you would think he'd be very optimistic about what you could do in the air. But he was also very pessimistic when a news journalist asked him if he thought a plane might ever fly across the ocean. And Orville said, "No flying machine will ever fly from New York to Paris because no known motor can run at the requisite speed for 4 days without stopping." And now we fly across the ocean in a matter of hours.
That's
and it's amazing.
It is amazing.
It's incredible.
And you have to wonder what the Wright brothers or the person at the patent office would think if they saw what had happened in the intervening century. It's pretty amazing. When you were doing the lessons to become a pilot, you kept it secret. In a chapter called Hidden Figure, you talk about how when a profile was done on your work as an entrepreneur and philanthropist in the Know Your Madisonian feature in the State Journal, that is the first time some of your family members learned that you were secretly taking flying lessons. Why did you keep it secret?
I think I had so many commitments and responsibilities and obligations. I was then the owner of a full-time music studio that I founded, so I had adult students and preschoolers during the day. My three kids were all in school at that time, so when I had free time, I would go out to the airport and take a lesson and come back. And I think it was because I just wanted to do it without somebody saying, "Well, are you almost done? Or how much more do you have to do? And when are you going to do this? And when are you going to do that?" It was almost like a escape and a hobby. And it took me about 2 years to get my pilot's license because I just did it in between other family responsibilities, and I couldn't go flying on weekends or in the evenings when family was home. So really, nobody knew that I was taking flying lessons. Nobody.
And at that time, I'm guessing that the controls were quite different than now. I mean, everything has become so computerized and,
right.
You know, a lot more devices and,
right.
and assistance than back then. What do you think the biggest change you've seen from when the very first plane that you were getting flying lessons on to now, what's the biggest difference? And are you glad you learned back then?
Yeah, I'm glad I learned back then. I met good people that were colleagues that were kind enough to help me and take me under their wing. I think the biggest difference is now, as you said, we have glass cockpits. and Garmin and GPS shows you where you are, shows you all the traffic in the area. You know what your fuel level is. Flight planning is a breeze. People can ask me if I will take them somewhere, and I just look at my iPad and I put the destination down, and I know how much fuel I need. I know what the frequencies are. I know what the wind is, how long it's going to take me, all of that. But I'm glad I learned when I did, because I understand how to figure it all out for myself also.
And if for some reason the controls go wrong or something doesn't function, you've got sort of the underlining basic stuff there as well.
I still keep paper maps and sectionals in my plane and pull them out and use them. Yeah.
And what do you think the biggest challenge you faced because of your gender? In other words, was it getting in your own head and sort of telling yourself you could do it? Or was it actually breaking through certain restrictions that were going to be placed on you? If you look back at your determination to become a pilot and then becoming the pink pilot, what was the biggest obstacle that maybe you had to overcome that others did not? Those 28 other men you just saw at a meeting, but what extra fight did you have to fight?
Yeah. I don't know, Emily, if it was a fight at the time, but I will say that when I finally did get my pilot's license, and I also tell some of these stories in the book, I was a people pleaser, and I always did what everybody wanted me to do. And when you finally realize that you are the pilot in command, and you're the only one that is up in that plane flying through bad weather or storms or whatever, you are responsible for people's lives and making a decision. And so it was acknowledging that. And I do have a sense of humor. When you read some of these stories, you can hear some of that sense of humor come through. But that was the biggest change, was knowing that I had to be responsible and I had to be accountable to myself and that plane. And I think what happened is when I finally got my pilot's license, that changed my life. And I put that in a story too, that it used to be when we were at social events or when I'd be out in the public and they'd say, oh, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I'm a music teacher. They'd go, oh, and then they'd move on. There was no further question. But when I would say, well, I'm a pilot and I teach aviation, all of a sudden their eyebrows would raise and they'd go, really? And how did you do that? And I'd say in a short sentence, I became visible in a new way that I never had experienced before.
I think you call part of that chapter Hidden Figure too, because you were hidden and then you became visible. And with the people pleasing, there was a quote you included about how you shouldn't set yourself on fire to keep others warm. You know, that you sort of have to set these boundaries, which you had to do with your own mother and with all kinds of people who flew along. We're going to look at more lessons from the pink pilot when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Diane Ballwig, and we are talking about her book, Into the Wind, Above the Clouds, Love at First Flight, Cruising with the Pink Pilot. I noticed that in the book you include examples of many different airports you've landed at, different continents, photos from Africa, and all kinds of accounts, and how when you would tell people how many places you went, it was a good way to get them to shut up. Like if they thought you weren't, I forget if it was Iceland or somewhere where you were going and they didn't know if you were ready to be in the plane, and all you had to do is tell them how many airports you'd landed at.
Well, when I started flying, I was taking lessons at Maury Airport in Middleton, and I always have lists, but one of my goals was to land at 100 different airports. So even when I was given the sign-off that I could solo, I would fly around and land at new airports, and they would roll their eyes when I'd come back like, oh my gosh, now where did you go, Diane? But I landed at 100. 100 was up in Ironwood, Michigan. Took some school friends there, and it was so much fun to keep a list in the back of my logbook that then my 200th airport was Memphis, Tennessee, and I took a girlfriend and her daughter down to a wedding in Hilton Head, and on the way back, we stopped at Memphis, Tennessee, and we had absolutely top-notch hospitality and service, so that was memorable. And number three, the one that you're referencing, Emily, was I went to Iceland. I went on a tour, and I extended my stay there for an extra day, and I called the airport at Reykjavik and set up a flight lesson with an instructor there. Now, I flew there commercial. I didn't fly my plane there. But when I got to the airport, and I said to the very handsome young flight instructor, tall guy, and he looked at me like, oh gosh, it's an old lady, and what does she know? And I said to him, I don't care where we fly, you know the area, but I want to land at four different airports. That's my only request. When we got in the plane, and I'll keep this short and sweet, he wouldn't let me take the controls or the rudder pedals or anything. He let me do one little thing at a time until I could prove that I knew what I was doing. And we ended up landing on a little island off the south coast of Iceland between two volcanoes. We landed on a beach. We landed in very interesting tour places in Iceland. And we came back and landed. Number four was Reykjavik, Iceland, the main airport there. And as he was filling out my bill for services and I was writing in my logbook, I looked at him. And I will repeat this again. He was a very tall, handsome, young flight instructor. I looked at him and I said, would you mind signing my logbook, or do you have a stamp or something? Because this is a really important landing spot. This is an important flight to me. And he said, why is that? And I said, well, Reykjavik is the 400th airport that I've landed at. And his eyes all of a sudden got really big. And he said, I'm trying to build airtime so that I can fly with Icelandic Air as a commercial pilot. And he was like, his breath was, and he said, and I think, and you could see he was mentally calculating, I think I've landed at maybe nine different airports. And all of a sudden, without bragging or saying anything, there was a new respect for somebody that had landed at hundreds of airports when he'd only landed at nine. And it was a very memorable trip.
That's great. And you also had a goal of flying on all seven continents.
Six continents. They don't have general aviation in Antarctica. But I have logged flight time on five continents and been to South America three times, actually with trips with WISO as a chaperone, the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestra. I have booked the flight lesson ahead so I could go out with an instructor. And every single time they were canceled for various reasons, either weather, or one time they canceled at the day of my appointment because they were repaving the little runway. And I feel badly. I still want to go and log flight time in South America, but it makes you understand the system and the freedom that we have here in the United States. Wisconsin has about 112 different airports in one state. It's incredible. And people say, do you have to put in a request or make an appointment to fly? Nope. I can just go out to my hangar. I talk to the control tower, but I can fly anytime I want. Basically, we have a really very open, wonderful system in the United States.
So you still have flying in South America on your bucket list.
Yep, it's still on my bucket list.
And you know, bucket list, I think, came up in your very first sentence of this book. You open with a sentence, some people call it a bucket list. I mean, so why do you open with that sentence, some people call it a bucket list?
Well, then I give some examples about some people want to go to every NFL ball game, and some people want to go to every national park or visit every state. My bucket list was to land at 100 different airports, and that was the start. But then it grew to many, many more things. Keeping a list of all the airports that I've landed at, having a plane, logging flight time on all six continents. It's been a really great ongoing adventure. It never ends. And people say, do you get tired of flying in and out of Madison? No, never. It's beautiful every time you depart and you see the lakes and the Greenland. I also did skydiving out of Kenosha. And when you skydive out of Kenosha, you can see the opposite shore of Lake Michigan. Mm-hmm. And Michigan, you can see the skyline from both Milwaukee and Chicago, and you can see the green farmlands of Wisconsin. I mean, and that's only from one place. We really have a beautiful, and I call it Mother Earth, and we need to take care of it, which people don't understand sometimes.
And you write about flying as a spiritual experience, that there's something so miraculous about the variety, the different kinds of beauty. I think you also mentioned having that Earthrise picture, you know, that the picture of Earth from space puts everything in a different perspective. Right. And you get that every time you lift off above
and
the clouds.
And I know this for Joseph P. Allen was an American astronaut. Then they asked them what made it worth us going into space. And a lot of people brought up the geography and the experimental medicines that they could provide and learning more about the solar system and all that. But Joseph P. Allen, an American astronaut, said if the only reason that we went into space was to get the picture of our Mother Earth, Earthrise, it was worth it because we realized that we are all from one home. And gee, in this day and age, more and more, I wish people would realize that we all live on the same home and we really are all brothers and sisters under our one Mother Earth. And we need to take care of her.
Take care of her and take care of each other.
Yes,
absolutely.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to talk to you about fear because you mentioned that you accepted an invitation to go skydiving. And I think for many people, if they picture doing what you're doing with the, you know, flying over the Kalahari Desert or the Victoria Falls or flying in different kinds of weather and everything, fear would kick in. It's scary to contemplate doing something that puts us in a free fall in the case of the skydiving or just venturing away from the safety of Earth. Mm-hmm. And I know you put a lot of time in the book into statistics showing that flying is safer than driving. And maybe you can share a little of that, but also even if you rationally know some of that, you're still gonna, you know, feel afraid sometimes at doing something that seems different.
Yeah, you do take chances, but they're calculated chances. I mean, before I go out in my plane, I always do a pre-flight check. You make sure you've got fuel. Literally, when you're in the air and now with a glass cockpit, you know when there's planes 20 miles away from you. The one statistic that I give to people is that if you were born and raised in a moving vehicle on a road, you would die somewhere in the age of 2. But if you were born and raised in an airplane and spent your whole life in the air, you would die somewhere in the age of 76. And so there's different data and statistics in the stories, too, that really cause you to think about it. And the best way to break your fears is to face them. My mother did not like that I was going skydiving at all. And I looked at her and I said, Mom, if President Bush can do it when he's 90, which he did, I can do it when I'm 60. So that was another joke.
For many adults that I know, they are afraid of flying, have to take sedatives to go on a flight. I think maybe it's because even if you know statistically that planes are safer than cars, it seems so catastrophic if it did happen. But you have a whole chapter in here about how we are only born with 2 fears. Can you talk about that? How is it that we become afraid of flying?
It's a lot of warnings. The 2 fears are, and this is again from science research, they say that babies are born with 2 fears, the fears of loud noises or of falling. And I tell people you can look at that if you're holding a baby in your arms and you don't drop them, but you let them go down a little bit, their arms will
They get that startle reflex
in the air. Mm-hmm. Or if they're sleeping or they're sitting quietly and all of a sudden you go shout or you make a loud noise in their ears, they'll do the same thing. They'll startle. So you're born with 2 fears. Those are the 2. The other fears are, and you know this, it's when everybody says to you, oh, be careful, don't go too close to there, don't touch that, it's hot, be careful when you ride your bike, stay on the side. There's so many times that I catch myself saying, oh, don't do that, or oh, be careful, or oh, watch out, that we just grow up with feeling fear.
But it's hard because having raised, you know, 3 children and then 3 grandchildren now, it's a hard balance because you want them to venture out, to soar, to learn. At the same time, you don't want some catastrophic accident. It is really hard if you love someone to balance letting them find their way and making their own mistakes and learning from it to wanting to protect them from harm.
Right. But that's where you're teaching them. You're not shouting at them, oh, be careful, it's dangerous. You're saying, you know what, before you do that, let me tell you a little bit about how a stove or an oven works. Or if we're going to grill, you know, feel when you put your hand kind of close, do you feel how hot it gets? And you just have to train people and educate them without shouting at them.
Well, you also talk in the book about having the courage to face your fears and to take risks. But you've also got a chapter called If Only, and you talk about how sometimes it takes more courage to not fly, to cancel a flight. Can you talk about that, that sometimes courage is not taking that risk?
Right. Emily, I think that goes back to the education. I have a rule, and I would always tell my students that we're not going to fly somewhere if we have more than three if onlys. And there's a story in there, but it's, if only it weren't so windy. If only we had more fuel in the tanks. If only I would have gotten a good night's sleep last night. Whatever it is, you can't have more than three, or you can't have three or more. If I have more than three of those, then I don't fly. And there have been times where I really wanted to go see some friends. I can think of flying up to Madeline Island, but it was stormy weather. They only have one little runway up there, so there's not a choice of where or how you can land. When you're taking a passenger, that can sometimes be an if only, because you don't want your passengers to be afraid, or if they're a little bit vertigo or motion sickness, you don't want to get bumped around in the plane. So it's education and being logical about it. You still want to be safe. And I don't call that fear. I call that intelligent, common sense.
And sometimes it seems you have to be assertive as the pilot in command. I think you had someone who wanted to go duck hunting or something the next day.
Yeah.
And you realized that you were being pushed to take risks for somebody to, you know,
go
hunt
duck
ducks.
Hunting.
Right. Yeah. I would think back to the three if-onlys. Maybe there's some if-onlys where only one is needed.
That's probably true.
You know,
true.
Like if only there wasn't a tornado coming.
Yes. Or,
you know, that maybe there's
yes.
some. I was thinking about how vulnerable pilots are to the weather and how changeable and unpredictable, increasingly so, it seems, where you can start out and the day seems one way and you look at the forecast and it's not showing any problem. And then 2 hours later, the whole scene has changed.
Yeah. Whenever I do a flight, I have an iPad with a app called ForeFlight. You can see all the weather. I always call a weather briefer. You get update information. So it's true. You really do. I tell people I've become a weather geek because I'm always watching the weather. And you don't go when it's really bad storm situation. And every plane is different. Small planes can't handle it as much as larger commercial planes. But then on the other hand, if I'm taking a commercial flight somewhere and the flight is canceled due to maybe tornadoes or wildfires or something, and I hear people sitting in the waiting area complaining, oh, darn, you know, why can't we, blah, blah. I want to look at them and say, look, wouldn't you rather be safe than sorry? There is logic to decisions that are made. So it doesn't matter where it is or who it is. You've got to use common sense.
I want to ask you about some of the scariest and also some of the most exhilarating flights you've had. We'll do that in a moment when we continue with University of the Air. Back with Diane Ballwig, and we are talking about her book, Into the Wind, Above the Clouds, Love at First Flight, Cruising with the Pink Pilot. So many flights, so many adventures, many people you met along the way, sights you saw. Can you talk about an example of a flight where you were really scared but had to stay calm? I know you have a chapter called Calm, and something where your adrenaline is rushing and you have to quickly adapt.
Yeah, there probably are a couple. People ask if I was ever in an emergency situation, and I never looked at it as an emergency. I knew I could fly the plane and land, but there were times where you had to put on your big boy pants, as I say, and be the pilot in command.
Or your pink pants.
My pink pants, yes. One was I was My daughter was in high school, and we flew down to the Florida Keys for spring break with her friends. And we were flying back to Wisconsin, so it was spring. And the weather when we left Florida, of course, was wonderful and warm. But as we were coming north back home to Wisconsin, we started to run into cloudy weather and snow and conditions. You lose 2.5 degrees of temperature for every 1,000 feet you are in the air. So it gets colder. And if you're in clouds where there's moisture, you can pick up icing, and that's dangerous. So I know that we were coming up to Illinois, and I was calling Champagne Approach and saying, we need to climb above the clouds. We were entering the clouds. And they said, oh, just a minute, we're going to hand you off to Springfield or something. So then I called Springfield, and they said, stand by, we're busy. And I just kept getting put off. And it finally, we really were picking up icing, and that destroys your lift in the plane. And I got on the radio, and I said, we are descending, because we would come into warmer air. I didn't ask. I said, we are descending. And just like that, I was getting reports from pilots. Oh, we broke out of the clouds at 10,000 feet or 12,000 feet, or the clouds stopped when we got here. But it was one time where I learned that you have to be the pilot in command. And as soon as we got down out of the clouds and it was warmer temperatures, the ice started just flying off in sheets from the window and the leading edge of the wing. You don't have windshield wipers on a plane. And so that was a turning point moment that I remember.
Why don't you have windshield wipers? It would just be too fast and fly off or something.
Yeah, you're going so fast and you get backwash from the propeller that windshield wipers wouldn't do any do any good.
You know, when you were talking about communicating with the people below and saying we are descending, that reminded me of the, it's a funny but important chapter you have. It's called KISS.
Oh, yeah.
And it's about community, and you have another one about communication, but just the importance of clear, simple messaging and the problem of acronyms that nobody can understand. But can you talk about KISS?
That is like the prime topic with many discussions that especially couples love. I guess the chapter is titled KISS, and it stands for Keep It Simple, Stupid. So EAA, Air Venture in Oshkosh, they have a weekly newsletter, and they always send out a question. Sometimes they're collecting data or statistics. Maybe they just want opinions from pilots. But keep in mind, the major group of pilots are men. So when they get answers, you know that it's pretty much a male-dominated population. One time they asked the question, what do you remember more fondly, your first kiss or your first solo flight? And the answer that they shared was this, and I write it in the book. It's dot, 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 well, and lots of pauses. I think it could have been, was it Barbara or maybe it was Nancy? It was probably during our junior year, because that's when we went to prom. And oh, no, wait, I think it was Veronica. And it goes on and on that, you know, they clearly didn't remember who their first kiss was or where it was. But, in capital letters, B-U-T, but, my first solo flight. Oh, it was on Thursday, August 18th. I woke up at 5:49 a.m. My lesson was at 8 o'clock. The temperature was 71 degrees outside, and he gave every single detail, the tail number of the plane, who the instructor was, when he took off, what he did. And then he said, as I took off for my first solo flight, I looked down and there was my flight instructor standing outside the terminal building, waving at me in his blue shirt. And I was wearing my yellow t-shirt that I just bought at EAA. So he even knew the colors, and everybody laughs at that. And we've had funny stories about people, and I've said, do you remember what your first kiss was? And oh my goodness, there's always lots of fun shared stories with men and women.
But also then the acronym KISS for Keep It Simple, Stupid.
Yes. FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, is known for tons of acronyms. It goes on and on. And they actually have t-shirts and coffee mugs that they sell up at AirVenture that say, we're not happy, the FAA, we're not happy till you're not happy. That's their motto. And when I go to seminars or am at sessions, they use so many acronyms. Really, there are pilots that raise their hand or ask, and even the people that are presenting don't know and have to look it up. So, yes, that's a story in all of life. Keep it simple, stupid, especially when you're in a plane or you're in a life and death situation and you want to look up some information.
But I think in that case, too, you had it was a male instructor who was criticizing you for adding unnecessary thank you and saying, oh, these women that talk too much. But then you overheard a lengthy conversation between men chatting about all kinds of things while...
We were on the same frequency, and it was on a Sunday morning where they have fly-in pancake breakfast at airports. And he did. He didn't like it that every time I talked to a control tower or any approach agency, I was... ended with thank you because I was used to it. Well, these two men were having a conversation about, hey, Bob, did you take your family to the fly-in pancake breakfast? Yeah, it was really good and cheap. They had good maple syrup, and it went on and on. And finally, the instructor that I was with, and I know who it was, he just said, would you get off of the frequency? You don't need to talk about it. And so that was kind of funny. But there's humor in the air, too. I remember flying back a long trip, and I put this in there, from Lincoln, Nebraska. And you go by your tail number. And my tail number is November N6303 Tango T. And I called the Lincoln in Nebraska Tower, and I said, Lincoln Tower, this is November 6303 Taxi, ready to tango. And even when you're not a pilot, you know what I meant. I mixed up the T words. And this instructor, the same one, looked at me like, oh, you dumb broad, you don't know what you're saying. And just like that, the Lincoln Tower man voice came back on the frequency and said, well, November 6303 Tango, I get done at 8 o'clock, and I know a great place to go dancing if you can stay around. And I thought, you know, there wasn't anything dangerous about it. He knew exactly what I meant. We're still human beings. You have to have a little sense of humor. So we still laugh about that one.
You were a teacher of aviation, and you've also talked about many students who came through the program and were changed by it. Some who went on in aviation, but some who were changed as people. Do you want to talk a little bit about the students you taught aviation to?
Right. I do see them regularly. I have one student that is a lead commander for the Blue Angels, the top flying squadron in the country. I have several that are commercial pilots. It's just amazing. I can think of the ones that are now certified flight instructors. Some work for security. There's a couple that are in the Air Force. Every single one of them, Emily, has a story to tell. And I love having reunions with them. And they love what they're doing. One called one day and said, I just reached the dream of my lifetime. I'm a commercial captain for American Airlines out of O'Hare. I was laughing on the phone because he wasn't a good student and he was always falling asleep. And on the phone, I said, Ross, my goodness, what happened to you? And he said, three words, and this means a lot to teachers. He said, I grew up. As a teacher, you never give up hope with people because you don't know. They can hear, they see, they listen. Sometimes it just takes a little while, but they've done amazing things. We flew home one night from a dinner banquet in Oshkosh, and I turned off all the cockpit display lights, and my students were looking at the ceiling window at the stars, and all I did was say, what do you think? And I remember exactly who this was also. John sat in the back, and he said one word. He just said, awesome. And I just thought, he gets it.
Yes, and I know you were a music teacher, too, before.
Yeah, I was a music teacher. But we belonged to a family business program at the university, at the Fluno Center there. And one time, and the people all know me, we've been in this group, it's a large group, for a long time. But during a coffee break, we were standing out in the lobby having some coffee, and there was an interesting conversation with business people who were CEOs or CFOs, and they were talking about their administrative paychecks and what they made a year, what they paid people. And one of the bank executives said he made $253,000 a year, and then there was another that was a head of a nonprofit. He made $172,000 a year, and they were talking about all these high salaries. And then they looked at me, and they knew that I was a part-time aviation teacher, and that teachers don't make a lot of money. And they looked at me, and they said, "What do you make?" And I paused for a minute to consider my philosophy as a teacher. In dollars, it's far less than what they make, but in impact, it might be considered greater. So I looked humbly at this circle of good friends that I knew, and I replied, I make a difference. And they smiled and they nodded and they shook their heads in affirmation. And that alone was gratifying. You don't know what those benefits are worth.
And that's such a beautiful idea of making a difference instead of a living. And you have a chapter on paychecks and also on how human beings that you should be, not focus right. So much on having.
Yep, on the back of my calling cards, and it's been there for 25 years, and my kids they roll their eyes when I say this, but I told my students too, we're called human beings, not human havings. If you have to decide what's more important, having more or being more, it's more important to be more. I've said that many times.
I'm curious about the transition you made from music to aviation. You write in your book about music being like aviation, something beyond words, and then that there's certain things about learning an instrument that also apply to flying. Tell me about that.
Right. People often ask that question, and what I say to them, there's so many ways that being a music teacher and playing music are similar. You have to pay attention to the details. You have to focus. In music, it's the dynamics, the tempo, the time, and the key signature, but in flying, it's a cockpit display of altitude, airspeed, vertical speed, and fuel gauges. Another similarity is you have to work as a team. Maybe a duet or an ensemble, a quartet, but in flight you have to listen to weather briefers and different crew people. As in music, it's the conductor, but in flying it's the CFI, the certified flight instructor. Communication in both areas is vital. You have to tune your instrument just like you have to tune your plane. You use your left brain and your right brain, as you have to pay attention to the intellectual data and detail, but you also savor the creative and the artistic expression of your performance, whether you're on a stage or in a cockpit. You play the guitar with your hands or you play the yoke in the plane.
That's beautiful, and also it seems both are a sort of universal language. You can make music with people and pick up their rhythms and their instruments and their ways of making music. And one thing that impressed me about your book was just how many cultures, how many diverse types of people you encountered, and it kind of brings people together rather than pushing them apart.
Yeah. It's really amazing to fly. I rented a plane in Japan, in Tokyo, for a reason, and I flew around the summit of Mount Fuji. And if I hadn't done that, I never would have seen it because it was cloudy the whole time. And I cut up through the clouds, and it was beautiful, as usual.
At the end of your book, and maybe this is the teacher in you, you've got assignments.
Yes.
And, you've got the glossary of terms and everything, but then you give assignment lists.
Yes.
And talk to me about what you're most hoping for people to get from the book and from your story of being the pink pilot.
Right. I really do, Emily. I put at the end, it's kind of like an afterword where I say, keep in mind, I've been a lifetime teacher, so you have an assignment. And you actually have several assignments which have generated wonderful discussion, again, where I'm learning. And I've had couples come up to me and say they're having dinner discussion that even though they may have been married 40 or 50 years, they've never had discussions like this before because they took that assignment seriously. And it also has one assignment if you want extra credit. So the assignments are you have to make a list of what are your accomplishment goals in life, what are your destination goals, and I give some examples. But then the third list, which is the one for extra credit, is who are the most influential people in your life? And you have to list 10 that have positively impacted maybe what you've done or the decisions that you've made or the education. And I say it might be a grandma or an aunt or an elementary school teacher that's no longer with us, but you need to keep them in mind and thank them. If they're still living, make sure you thank them. And at one of my book talks, somebody said, you need to add a fourth column. Oh, really? This is where I was learning. They said the fourth column is, who are people, a list of 10, that you have influenced or impacted, or that you are passing on a story of hope or believing in them, because it's not going to be a bright future. We're not going to give what we've learned to the next generation unless we do that. We act as their mentors and coach them along or give them hope. And so I started that. I have a sheet at home that I put my accomplishments and I say, you're never done. You should never have everything done. Destinations, people that have impacted my life, but also I'm always thinking about who is it that I am impacting in a positive way. It's that role model idea.
And I love the way you have this belief in lifelong learning with the ego flights, where you have young eagles, you know, children learning about aviation, but then you have the bald eagles for seniors. And it's an embrace, really, of one's entire life and how you're always learning, always having new adventures. Diane Balwig, thank you for being my guest. I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.